Welcome to the Marketplace Petrostate podcast, where we ask, is the United States becoming an oil and gas titan? And if so, what are the implications? Today's January 15th, 2013, and I'm Scott Tong, sitting at the Sustainability Desk. This week, a big-time expert on a big energy question, the bridge fuel question. Fracking has brought a boom in North American natural gas. So, does natural gas transition us from a high-carbon life of today to a low-carbon tomorrow? And we'll have our weekly energy and environment BS detector. But first, the numbers and stuff. The national average price of gasoline skidded sideways down the road, up less than 1% this past month, to $3.26. Crude oil tanked up 7% that same period. That is North American West Texas Intermediate, now cost $93.84 a barrel. Natural gas rose 6% to $3.40 per million British thermal units. That's the unit of measure. I'm sure you knew that. Oil and gas stocks, the Dow Jones index of them, drilled up a modest 3% the past month. And S&P's Global Clean Energy Stock Index scorched up 7%. This week, the U.S. government launched a probe into Shell Oil's Arctic drilling practices. Its latest equipment failure was the grounding of a rig on New Year's Eve. 2012 turned out the hottest year on record in the lower 48. A federal climate advisory committee issued a draft paper noting that climate change the past 50 years is due primarily to human activities. U.S. oil imports are headed for a 25-year low. And the folks at the World Economic Forum at Davos voted that climate change is a top global risk. This is the Petrostate podcast. And now, the natural gas bridge fuel question with energy and climate brainiac Michael Levy. Officially, he's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new peer-reviewed paper, which means lots of charts, asks, is natural gas transporting us to a low-carbon future? Michael Levy, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Let me first ask you to kind of set the context of this bridge fuel conversation. So if we're in this high-carbon energy world of today, and we want to get to a low-carbon world of tomorrow, embedded is an assumption that we can't get there immediately. Yeah, why is that the case?
The infrastructure that we have tends to stick around for a long time. Cars stick around for about 15 years, power plants for 40 or 50 or 60 years or more, buildings for hundreds of years. So decisions that we made 50 years ago often still stick with us. The second reason that you can't make an overwhelming transformation overnight is because it's not clear that we have the tools available to do that quickly. We have renewable energy technology, and in some places it's economic, but it is usually more expensive and considerably more expensive than alternatives. And in particular, if you pushed it at a very large scale, the fact that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow would mean you would have large reliability problems. Nuclear energy is very expensive right now. It could have its costs be brought down. It is established and demonstrated at scale, unlike these other options, but we have challenges with waste disposal and public acceptance. And globally, we also have a challenge with nuclear proliferation, the spread of nuclear weapons. We talk about a third option for getting to zero carbon energy called carbon capture and sequestration, where we would take the carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired or gas-fired power plants and capture them and bury them underground. But again, that while the technology is there, we haven't demonstrated it at scale, so we don't really know how much it would cost. And we don't have the infrastructure there in order to deploy it rapidly.
Okay. So then we have these challenges you laid out with technology and scale and these legacy challenges. And into this conversation comes the North American shale gas revolution, as it were. Of course, the proponents are saying, well, this is the bridge fuel that can take us there. It doesn't emit as much as coal for electricity. So if we use a lot of it now, it can kind of take us to that future.
The shale gas boom entered at a special time in the politics of American climate policy. We had had a set of high expectations for comprehensive climate policy. If you go back to the 2008 presidential campaign, every major candidate said that they would implement an ambitious cap-and-trade program to reduce U.S. carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. By 2009 and 2010, that was pretty much off the table, certainly by 2010. And here comes the shale gas boom with another way, at least in the near term, of reducing U.S. emissions. And so that leads to this boom in talk about natural gas, not as a permanent solution, because it isn't a zero-carbon energy source, mm-hmm. but as a bridge, as something that lets you avoid high-emissions coal in the short term while you get the rest of your house in order.
You did this modeling, and so let's talk about what you found. You have at least two big conclusions based on two different destinations.
That's right.
One is to 450 parts per million as a measurement of carbon dioxide in the
right.
atmosphere. So if that's the other shore, what did you find?
Right. So I'm looking at this at a global level, not just at an American level, because if you just look at the U.S. piece, you can make pretty much anything happen globally, depending on what other countries do.
Uh-huh.
So I focused on this 450 parts per million goal, which is largely consistent with an even chance of keeping global temperature rises below 2 degrees, which is where a lot of international diplomacy and climate policy focuses.
Celsius.
And I found Celsius. Yes, yep. I should say that. When you say 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, it doesn't seem quite so solid.
Yeah.
one of my pet peeves. if you boost natural gas and then reduce it as part of this bridge, and then you say, well, what happens if we just delay the transition to zero carbon energy instead? Let's say we just keep coal around for a bit longer. The ultimate temperature difference isn't all that large. Climate change is always a confusing subject to talk about because we talk about needing to take action now, which is correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But most of the emissions that make the big difference don't come in the next 10 years. They come later on. The reason we have to take action now is because the system has a lot of inertia. And if you want to change the outcomes in 20 or 30 years, you need to start acting now.
Are you saying that if you spend the next 2 decades, okay, we can use a fair amount of coal for the next 2 decades, or we aggressively move to natural gas and use put a lot more natural gas into the energy system, the emissions long-term future is not too different?
If you assume that deployment of zero carbon energy happens in the same way in both cases,
mm-hmm.
then the ultimate temperature impact is not nearly as different as a lot of people believe and is not nearly as different as I previously believed.
That in the long term, there is a significant difference between the two fossil fuels. But if you're talking about in the next 20 years, the difference is not that dramatic.
That's right. And the problem is that if you get into the very long term and you're talking about one fossil fuel versus another without any way to capture and store the carbon dioxide, you're in deep trouble either way.
Can I ask it this way? If you are looking at the difference in emissions between natural gas and coal in the long term, there's a significant difference. By the time you see a big difference, we will have way blown past 450.
Right. I would break it down a bit more.
Yep.
You know, we use the term short-term, medium-term, long-term in very loose ways. If you're focused on a goal like 550 parts per million, natural gas can hang around long enough to make a pretty substantial difference between that and coal.
So then if your target is a less ambitious 550, then natural gas being a bridge to there is a much more significant player?
In particular, it's a more significant player in its direct emissions impact.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So just the straight difference between the amount of carbon dioxide emitted by coal, let's say for 3 or 4 or 5 decades, and the amount of emissions from natural gas over that kind of period is large. And what you wouldn't want to do is have coal stick around in the hopes that you'll get an early transition to zero carbon energy and then end up not having that transition happen. Then you're stuck with much higher emissions than you needed to have.
I could see some voices in this debate saying, aha, natural gas, Michael Levy says it doesn't get you there. It isn't a bridge to 450, so this shale gas thing is not worth talking about. Is that the right conclusion from your paper?
I don't think it's the right conclusion. The first important thing to keep in mind is that this is a paper that says if you have the choice between scenario A and scenario B, here are some different features of them that you should keep in mind in making that choice. But it also says there are a lot of features you haven't talked about. So there maybe economic advantages to moving first to natural gas before moving to zero carbon energy. And the paper doesn't look at economics. It may be that the politics of moving from natural gas to zero carbon energy are easier than the politics of moving from coal to zero carbon energy. What I do say is that even if you are dead set on reaching a goal of 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, if you're not absolutely certain that we're going to be able to effect a transformation to zero carbon energy soon, a shift to natural gas gives you a big hedge. Because if you are stuck with a delayed transition to zero carbon energy, better to be stuck with somewhat lower emissions in the meantime. Because if those fuels hang around for a while, that will actually make a big impact on temperatures in the long run.
One article described it as a little bit of an insurance policy against political inaction.
I think it's an important insurance policy against political inaction. I think that's a big part of the value of natural gas as a bridge fuel.
Is one takeaway here, a fundamental takeaway, is if we get to a point where carbon capture and storage, we make technology progress, it becomes commercial and scalable, it can change these emissions projections substantially?
I think that's right. It's a technical point in the paper. I make clear that when I talk about a natural gas bridge, I'm talking about natural gas without any kind of capture and sequestration.
Yeah.
In the long run, if you capture and sequester it, it counts to me as a zero carbon or near zero carbon energy source.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite zero carbon, but it's close. But again, I'll emphasize, I don't think anyone out there knows which of these zero carbon energy sources will become a cost-effective option, and I don't think anyone knows when each of them will become cost-effective options. I'd like to see us develop as many bets as we can with the hope that at least some of them come through.
Okay. So is another kind of basic takeaway that as far as natural gas being one of the big bets we put on to take us to that zero or low carbon future, if you have a pretty aggressive target, then the answer is maybe not.
And the answer is if you're depending on natural gas to get you to this low carbon future and you're not putting in the other pieces, you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Okay.
It is not going to do this for you by itself. And frankly, if you don't get on top of developing and really starting to push out those other sources soon, you're going to end up not being able to get to those most stringent targets.
Time seems to be a big underlying factor in all of this. That is, the more you wait, the harder all of these bridge scenarios tend to get.
That's absolutely right. Had I been doing this analysis 10 years ago, I might have come to a different set of conclusions. So yes, you do need to look at time.
Finally, let me ask you to play BS detector with me. The natural gas, the extraction process, fracking shorthand has triggered an awful lot of debate. Give me a myth or two on each side of the debate that's being perpetrated in the public discourse.
I would flag three big myths on the pro-natural gas side. One is that the boom in natural gas means that we don't need to worry about climate change for now because we are reducing our emissions anyhow. The second is that natural gas will somehow free us from dependence on foreign oil. There are a lot of issues there, the first being that natural gas does not currently go into our cars and trucks. And the third is we don't really need to worry about the local water impacts in particular of natural gas development, because if it's done right, then everything will be okay. I agree, if it's done right, then we're in good shape. But this is a diverse industry, and no one particularly cares if 99.9% of companies behave well if the 0.1% is the one that fouled up their water. And so we need smart regulation that facilitates development, but that reassures people.
In other words, if you have a case, the 0.01% example of a spill or something happening in this drilling process, you could have an outsized reaction and suddenly it changes
Right.
The politics. Okay,
and there's a related myth to that. There's a myth there that it's going to be extraordinarily costly if we put on smart regulations and make sure everything is done by the book. I don't think that's right.
The IEA
there have been estimates out there. The IEA says a 7% – and the IEA does not say a 7% addition to total costs. It says a 7% addition to capital costs, which are only a fraction of the total costs. It also says that if we did this in a comprehensive way in some places, we could actually save costs by developing better water infrastructure and by better understanding the resource so that we could frack less, produce more, improve the economics, and reduce the environmental impact.
So the other side, on the environmental side.
On the anti-side, look, myth number one is that if we allow natural gas development to happen, we're going to destroy the climate. That's just not true. The reality is that the practical impact of natural gas development right now is that it's replacing coal. And reducing emissions in the process. The second myth that gets perpetrated on the anti side is that methane leakage from natural gas development makes it as bad or worse than coal-fired power. And that's just not true. There have been no studies that look at actual field emissions of natural gas and that analyze them properly and come to the conclusion that methane emissions are large. Now, there are cost-effective opportunities to reduce methane emissions. I think those are important. There are efforts to better measure them. I think those are important. But this idea that we know that natural gas is worse than coal or that it's likely that natural gas is worse than coal, I think has taken on a life of its own and it's counterproductive.
That's very good. All right, Michael Levy, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Glad to have the discussion.
And that is the Marketplace Petrostate podcast for January 15th, 2013. Thanks all for listening. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong. Oh, and happy birthday, Dad.